I can see everyone. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I will have our marshal call court to order.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Riley, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Renee L. Werke presiding.
We are going to begin our calendar today on our Zoom platform, April 7, 2022. The rules of appellate court procedure do remain the same, even though we are appearing by Zoom. If you have any technical difficulties, which I did earlier this morning, signal by either moving your arms or raising your hand or something if you can't hear. Remember to mute yourself unless you're speaking so that we don't have any noise overload. Also, I want to remind you to introduce yourself as well as who you're speaking on behalf of before making your argument, and that's for our recording purposes. With that said, I'm going to ask our marshal to call the first case for consideration.
This is case number A211301, Darwin Boutain et al. Appellants versus Aaron Peterson, respondent.
And appellate counsel, when you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Michael Jorgensen. I'm the attorney representing the appellants in this matter, Darwin Boutain and Dina Boutain. This action started as an action for declaratory relief pursuant to Minnesota Statutes 555.101 et al. To confirm the existence and terms of an agricultural lease. The basic facts that gave rise to the initiation of this matter are as follows. The appellants were tenants on a 10-year written lease concerning approximately 1,600 acres of land located in Beltrami County, Minnesota, which was at least being formed in 2015. The landlords were trustees of a trust. But after the lease was entered into, the trustees split up the land and sold the land to approximately seven other buyers.
Mr. Jorgensen, would you agree with me that the facts are largely undisputed in terms of how this came about? I mean, all of us, as far as panel members, understand that your client, in fact, stepped into the shoes of renting or leasing, if you will, from Mr. Peterson after all of this transpired. Is that right?
Well, correct. I wouldn't say that all the facts are.
The historical context.
All right. So you guys take it the court would like me to move on to something more specific on the issues raised before the court. Is that correct?
Well, you know, my concern is this, not my concern. My question is this. You filed a declaratory judgment action and asked the court to make a determination that the lease, I presume that what you're asking for is that the lease is valid, that there was this agreement between your client and respondent, Mr. Peterson. So why was the judge precluded? Why could the judge not make that decision based on your complaint that you had a lease, but payment hadn't been made? How do you survive that?
We survive that because there is a reason why the lease payment wasn't made. Before I proceed, I note that the timer isn't running. Is it supposed to be running?
My goodness, thank you. Thank you for calling that to my attention. I should have been paying attention. It's now running. You get the benefit of that.
Thank you. There was a reason why the payment wasn't made timely.
Mr. Jorgensen, my question to you is the reason why the payment wasn't made wasn't alleged in the complaint as I read the complaint.
The reason it wasn't...
Is that right?
That's correct. The reason why it wasn't paid timely wasn't referenced in the complaint. Our complaint is one for declaratory judgment, asking the court confirm a lease, determine the validity of that lease, and interpret the terms of it. The equitable estoppel argument that we made was in reply to the respondents' arguments and in reply to the district court's first decision.
Well, let's go back to the complaint. Number 11 of your complaint says on March 18, your client sent a check to the defendant's attorney, but yet by the very same complaint, the money was due on March 1. So what I'm getting at is under what theory can we not say, well, look, March 18th is not March 1.
It is not March 1, but there's a reason why it was unpaid by March 1. And that's because of the actions of the respondent in initiating discussions but with the appellants to modify the terms of that lease. My clients were relying upon those negotiations.
So, counsel, my question is what is the legal authority that your clients are not bound by the existing lease while they are negotiating a new one?
The authority is equitable estoppel. In this case, the respondent initiated a course of action which my client relied upon to renegotiate the lease. In this case, the respondent wanted to change the terms of the lease. They wanted to limit my client to the acres that had already been tilled, which is less than one third of the total acres that were provided to him through the terms of the original lease.
Go ahead.
I just want to say back to my original question, you did not plead equitable estoppel as a potential basis for relief in your complaint.
Correct. The equitable estoppel argument came in reply to the arguments of the respondent and in reply to the trial court's first decision in this case.
You can help me, because when I read through the record, I didn't see anything in the record that came remotely close to suggesting that Mr. Peterson had approved the extension.
No, he did not approve it. He just simply led my client along, saying, well, let's talk about this lease. We want to change the terms. My client said, okay, well, if you're going to change or reduce my number of acres I get to farm, I want to reduce the amount of the rent.
Didn't that course of action occur after March 1st? I mean,
No.
When did it start?
January of 2021. The respondent sent a text message to my client, first introducing himself. And then when they got those texts going back and forth, there's several of them on that first date, wherein the respondent said, I'm thinking about just limiting you to the tillable acres you've already tilled. And I'm going to use the other acres for myself. In this case, he was going to hunt on them. But my client said, well, let's meet and let's talk about a new lease. And they were talking about trying to set up a new or a date to set up for that. Discussions concerning the new lease. That was initiated by the respondent in January.
So let's assume, I'll take all of that as true for the purposes of your argument. How does that representation, let's talk about a new lease, relieve your client of its obligation to continue paying under the existing terms of the lease until the parties reach some sort of new agreement? Because the principle of equitable estoppel requires some reliance. And there was no agreement that we are going to reach a new lease or what the terms of that lease would be. So I don't understand how equitable estoppel would relieve your clients of, even under the theory that you're arguing now.
The respondent in this case indicated to my client that he was willing to meet with my client to adjust the terms of that lease. My client wasn't going to spend $12,000 on for less than 100 acres of land for renting in 1 year. And he didn't want to pay that $12,000 knowing that the number of acres going to be allowed to him was going to be reduced by over two thirds. And so he relied upon those representations that they were going to meet discuss this new lease and not making that March 1st payment.
Well, I'm looking at the text messages that were in your client's affidavit and that you included in your brief.
Yeah.
And so we have the January text messages, and then we get to the February 23rd message.
Mm-hmm.
And respondent says, is that broken tractor yours? I plan on having my salvage guy come and take it out soon. If you don't want it, let me know. That does not sound like the lease is going to go on.
I don't interpret it that way. They're talking about a broken down tractor. It doesn't say that the lease was or was not going to continue. Please note that there's nothing issued by the respondent in this case to my client saying, forget it, you got to pay the entire March 1 payment. Granted, it's in the lease, but... That would tell my client, hey, look, you got to do something. Rather, all that there is that the respondent saying, let's meet, let's talk, let's figure out a date. And then there's this one text message from February.
Your complaint also has a specific provision, and that is that the money to be paid, I'm sorry, I had your complaint in front of me a few minutes ago, is right under the provision that talks about payment of rent. That there could be an extension of that payment your clients were aware that there could be an extension, but yet they didn't seek one. They certainly were aware of it because the predecessor in November was asked to extend that payment. Isn't that correct?
Well, no. First of all, the November payment was not extended. It was waived. That was waived by the prior owner, Tyler Nelson. There's an affidavit in the record indicating that he had waived that.
But that's what I'm getting at, is your clients were sophisticated enough to know and ask Mr. Nelson to either delay accepting payment or not to expect the payment as it was coming.
Well, they were aware of the terms of the lease that they could have asked for an extension. But
why didn't they?
Because they were in the midst of negotiating a new lease. I mean, when you're talking about changing the lease, why do you ask for an extension under the old lease? They were led to believe that they were going to come to an agreement. And so they didn't make that payment. And why were they led down that road? It's because of the statements made by the respondent, suggesting there's going to be a new lease with new terms.
Well, it sounds to me like they were just a little late in asking for that extension, but I want to turn your attention to the attorney's fees. That concerns me. To our awareness, the panel's awareness, there wasn't any adherence to Rule 11 procedures as far as sanctions. Can you explain to me a little bit from your point of view how the attorney's fee issue came to be awarded?
Well, I agree with you. The statute was not followed. The rules were not followed for the award of sanction-based attorney's fees. Rule 11 specifically requires that there be a motion brought separately, served upon the other party, and held for 21 days before filing with the court in order to ask for sanction-based attorney's fees. That was not done. The other method under the rules is to if the district court wants to award sanction-based attorney's fees.
What I want clarification on, Mr. Jorgensen, was it the respondents that asked for sanctions, or was this the court interpreting the request for attorney's fees as a request for sanctions?
And it's kind of unclear. Granted, the respondent asked for contract-based attorney's fees. If the court looks at the
contract does provide for attorney's fees. So
right.
that was what they asked for, is the provision for attorney's fees under the stated contract.
Correct. But the trial court ruled that the contract was void. The trial court can't void the contract and then later try and enforce it as it relates to the attorney's fees provision. If the contract was void, all of it's void. So contract-based attorney's fees should not have been awarded. And if the court looks at what the trial court's decision was, it said it was granting the respondent's motion. So granting the response request to award attorney's fees based on a contract the trial court already determined was void. That's not appropriate. And if it is sanction-based, because if you look at the body of the trial court's decisions, both of them, the one from May and the one from August, both suggest it's sanction-based attorney's fees. Well, the procedures that the rules call for and statutes require and case law requires were not followed. And as such, the award of attorney's fees should definitely be reversed. It did not follow the statute and it did not follow the rules. And in fact, if it's contract-based, the contract was determined void, so you can't enforce that particular provision of it. So the award of attorney's fees should be removed, should be reversed. And the court has, in its own decisions, Golden Nuggets case specifically indicates that if you don't follow the statutes, if you don't follow the rules, any award of attorney's fees, sanction-based attorney's fees, is an abuse of discretion. And so that should be overturned. And the other thing on the attorney fees I want to point out is, you know, we had, on the second decision, we had brought a motion for amended findings. And the trial court granted it by amending its findings and then later award the other side attorney's fees and us having to bring a motion for amended findings. It seems unjust. And in fact, is quite a disincentive for a litigant to bring a motion for amended findings to allow the trial court to correct its own errors before filing an appeal, knowing that they're going to be hit with attorney's fees from making the effort. It just seems unjust and I think inappropriate. And I know the court wanted to talk about attorney's fees. I think I've covered that part of it. I want to go back to our cause of action originally. You know, I want to address the point that the equitable estoppel argument was not made in our complaint, but we did make a claim for declaratory relief. And if the court looks at the case law, it is improper to dismiss a complaint for insufficiency if there's any basis to support the claim. There is evidence in the record that would suggest that the reason my client didn't make that payment by March 1 was because of those communications between the parties, relying upon the negotiations that were going on at the time. And there is a basis, there's facts in the record that support that claim. Now, even though it wasn't specifically referenced in our complaint, it is consistent with our complaint. And if it's consistent with our complaint, then there has to be a hearing.
So, counsel, procedurally, if the district court would have allowed you an opportunity to make a more definite statement, for example, in your complaint, would you have asserted different causes of action?
If, in fact, I know this was going to be an issue, hindsight's always 20/20. Yeah, I'd have referenced the equitable estoppel thing. But again, I didn't think I needed to. I put the issue before the court to enforce the validity of this contract and interpret the terms of it. The issue of equitable estoppel only comes up in reply to the defenses or arguments made by the respondent and the trial court's first decision. So
if I state that differently for you, just give me a moment here. Since you're saying that the actual contract was voided by the district court, that you would have some equitable contract claims that you would assert in the alternative. Is that what you're saying?
I would make an argument that equitable estoppel would have prevented the termination of the contract as a result of the late payment.
Okay. Thank you.
And also I would like to point out that, you know, the district court also dismissed the complaint alleging that there were no questions of fact. Well, clearly there are questions of fact. The trial court decided that the text messages do not form the basis of an equitable estoppel argument, don't form the basis to show that the parties were in negotiations at the time. That's clearly a question of fact. We presented evidence to the contrary. But the district court made a decision that it does not. The district court is not allowed to make resolve questions of fact on a summary judgment motion or a motion to dismiss based on Rule 12.03. You can't make determinations of fact in making and deciding those motions. And that's exactly what the trial court did. And so that was improper as well. And I see that I am out of time. I know I have a rebuttal, so I'll wait for the rebuttal.
You do. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll turn to respondent counsel then.
Good morning, your honors. May it please the court. My name is Patrick Rosenquist. I represent the respondent in this matter, Aaron Peterson. I think I'll start by addressing the appellant's original complaint. And I think that's what this all kind of boils back down to. You know, on one hand, appellants wish to enforce the original lease agreement. As this case progressed and we filed our motion to dismiss, their argument sort of evolved to one of equitable estoppel, asserting that at one point, not only had a new agreement been in the process of being negotiated, but a new agreement had been reached. If you will look at specific cases such as Gans v. Coca-Cola, you'll note that negotiations for a contract do not constitute a new contract. So the enforcement, and if you look at the original pleader's theory, when we're talking about facts, these facts have to be material facts?
Well, let's talk about facts. I mean, I find it confusing that we start with the declaratory judgment request. That means you look at the complaint, you decide if there's a cause of action, you do not consider documents outside of the complaint. Then we all of a sudden have other documents that are being submitted. So what happened? Where did it turn to a summary judgment determination?
Well, Your Honor, in contemporaneous with the summons and complaint, the appellants also filed a motion for a temporary injunction and or restraining order. If you're going to make the argument that, you know, we're seeking declaratory relief and we want an instrument construed, it would stand to reason that the appellants in this issue would at least provide the court the instrument. They're asking for my client to be enjoined from his own property based on their word and their word alone, without even giving the court the benefit of the lease agreement to review. Without that, it would serve as
it wasn't just the lease agreement. It wasn't just the instrument that was provided. I mean, there were text messages and other there were other documents that were submitted as well, right?
Well, that subsequently there were other documents, but the main document that needed to be construed, and it's a very simple document, is the lease agreement. And it unequivocally states that if the rent is not paid by March 1st, the contract is void.
All right. So I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but here's what I'm hearing you articulate. So tell me if I'm wrong. The other documents outside of the pleadings, are you saying were they considered by the judge in connection with the TRO? Is that why they were submitted?
Well, Your Honor, we submitted them the text messages were submitted by the appellants. We submitted the lease agreement. But
why would you do that if you have a declaratory judgment action? Why would you submit anything else?
That's a great question, Your Honor. But you know, I would say that I would venture if you're the one seeking declaratory judgment, which the appellants were, they would be the ones that would be submitting the documents, which they did not. And the court had no basis of which to make any sort of determination on, based on the appellant's original filings. And if they're asking the court to enforce a lease agreement, one would surmise that they would at the very least provide the court the opportunity to review the lease agreement, which they did not. And we wanted to inform the court because we're talking about April, right before planning season, where time is of the essence, that if you're going to enjoin my client from entering onto agricultural property, the court should at the very least be afforded the opportunity to review the lease agreement, because now we're a few weeks out from planning at that point.
I have a question for you. The judge made rulings both under Rule 12 and Rule 56. If we were to agree with you that we should affirm, which one do you think is your strongest argument?
Well, Your Honor, under Rule 12, 0.02e, I think the traditional pleading standard that should be applied is that is probably the stronger of the two. Is it possible any evidence which might be produced consistent with pleader's theory where relief should be granted? And, you know, the pleader's theory was that they should enforce the original lease agreement. And it's very, very simple. The original lease agreement states that you were to pay rent by March 1st. They did not. There's nothing to indicate that in the pleader's original theory or the appellant's original theory that there's any sort of ongoing negotiation or there's anything new that should be addressed. And if there was, that would make that complaint moot. If there was any sort of new negotiation that was being contemplated, then there wouldn't be any need to bring a complaint to enforce the original agreement.
So in light of your answer, counsel, I'm a little bit troubled by the district court's dismissal of the action with prejudice, because Mr. Jorgensen has, before the district court and now again today, identified an alternative basis to pursue relief. So it strikes me that because you're advocating today that the dismissal should have been a procedural one because the complaint failed to state a claim upon relief should be granted, that the district court's dismissal should be amended to be without prejudice. Do you want to comment on that?
Well, if it was to be without prejudice, then we'd be talking about a purported new agreement that we haven't seen reduced to writing. I am unaware that there is any sort of new agreement that has been facilitated. If you look at the quote unquote negotiations that appellants allege, there is absolutely no contact for 46 days. So if we're talking about the original lease agreement, which is what the complaint is all about, then that would be in and of itself its own thing. A new agreement would be an entirely different set of circumstances. If there was some sort of new agreement that needed to be enforced, then by all means, the appellants can certainly bring a cause of action. I don't think a dismissal with prejudice as to their original complaint would preclude them from doing that. The fact of the matter is there is no new agreement. There has never been a new agreement. There has been no negotiations regarding a new agreement. There's nothing there. And if there is a new agreement, by all means, the appellants certainly, I don't believe, would be precluded from bringing that if it was truly their intent to farm that particular parcel.
I have a question about attorney's fees. As I understand it, you requested attorney's fees under the lease contract. The judge ruled under Rule 11 and Minnesota Statute 549.211. And I agree with Judge Werke that the provisions on Rule 11, the sanctions provisions, were not followed. So how can we uphold or affirm the district court's decision on attorney's fees?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, I would say that procedure was indeed not followed from a technical standpoint. There's not a lot I can do from a legal perspective to argue that that there was an opportunity for, there should have been an opportunity for appellants to at least answer in order to show cause as to why attorney's fees shouldn't be applied as it relates to sanctions. That being said, appellants did make a separate motion to amend findings and did argue vociferously against the implementation of sanctions. Now, if we're going to be technical about how
I didn't see that any putative fees were ordered.
I don't believe that there were. I mean, we asked for the provision 6 to be implemented and that attorney's fees be awarded.
Here's what we struggle with as an appellate body. Paragraph 6, all legal fees for noncompliance will be covered by renter. How do we know which of the legal fees are for noncompliance if we agree they were, that there was noncompliance?
Well, that is a good question. I think if you were to look at the contractual component of it,
I've looked at your time and billing statement, and I don't know how we could possibly ferret out what is because the money wasn't paid March 1 versus any negotiations, telephone calls, the discussions. What about the tractor and the property? I mean, how are we in a position to determine what fees are appropriate?
Certainly, Your Honor. And I think if you take a look at respondent's brief, we do allow an avenue for that, but it wouldn't, from our perspective, it wouldn't fall on the shoulders of this court. If there was a remand, I think it would be appropriate to remand for that particular reason, to at least allow an opportunity for the appellants to show cause as to why sanctions should not be implemented. And if the court does indeed at that, after that hearing, find that fees should be implemented, to go through and parse out how they should be applied specifically. Having said that, I'll just defer to the court for any further questions, or else I'll yield the remainder of my time.
It appears there are no further questions. Mr. Jorgensen, back to you for your rebuttal.
I'm sorry, I had you on mute. I want to address one of the comments made by opposing counsel that there were no negotiations and there was no agreement reached. Again, questions of fact, which would bar a motion to dismiss under 12.03 or a summary judgment motion. But the point is the parties did meet on March 10th and an agreement was struck, which was later withdrawn a day later. The only reason I referenced that agreement on March 10th was not to enforce it, but to reflect that, to show the court that parties were negotiating. The negotiations were continuing. It wasn't until March 11th, the day after that meeting, that Mr. Peterson notified my client that, nope, that's it. I don't want you on the property anymore. Then my client knew the negotiations were over. Nothing occurred prior to that date that would lead my client to believe that negotiations were over. So negotiations were ongoing. And again, all leads to the fact that there was questions of fact to be decided that the trial should not have made under Rule 12.03 or in a summary judgment motion. As far as the comment that the lease agreement was not provided, yes, that's unfortunate. That was an error. I should have done that. It's not that I didn't do it intentionally. It just wasn't added. But the point is that the trial court had that lease agreement at all aspects of this litigation. Anytime the trial court made a decision, it already had that lease in its possession. If it wasn't from me, it came from the respondent. It doesn't matter. The trial court had it. So to argue that it was appropriate to dismiss the complaint because the lease agreement wasn't attached to the complaint is inappropriate. The trial court had that lease agreement at all times in all relevant phases of this litigation. So that really has no impact on the outcome of this thing. Opposing counsel has argued that, well, if the court's going to remand this thing, is just for a purpose of sorting out how much attorney's fees should be awarded, I think is inappropriate. The attorney's fees issue comes down to whether or not the trial court followed the appropriate procedure to award sanction-based attorney's fees. And if it did not, the attorney's fees judgment is wiped out. And you start over. And I'd argue that it should be remanded in its entirety so that we can address the original complaint, the declaratory relief action, and all aspects of it that are consistent with our original complaint, and also address any other issues that come up through that litigation. And if during that subsequent remand and litigation below that there is some thought that attorney's fees should be awarded, then the proper procedure should be followed. A motion under Rule 11.02,
Mr. Jorgensen, as I understand it, respondent's attorney filed a motion for attorney's fees under the contract. They Correct. Weren't asking for sanctions in Correct. The first part. So why wouldn't we just remand it for the judge to make a ruling on their motion?
Well, because I think it's easily resolved. If you're going to order that the attorney's fees has to be based upon the contract, and the court affirms that the contract is void, then you can't do that. You can't award attorney's fees on a void contract. If you're going to void the contract, all provisions of it are void. So either way, the award of attorney's fees was not appropriate. I'll open up as well. Any additional questions? Okay.
It appears not. Thank you to both attorneys for appearing on our Zoom platform.